I'd like to invite you to Genesis chapter 33 tonight as we read the story of Jacob and Esau and as they meet each other again for the first time in over 20 years. Last Sunday night, we went into the story of Jacob and Esau coming together and all the issues that had happened between them. And Jacob goes to bed the night before the big meeting, and the angel comes and he wrestles with him. And last week we talked about what it means to wrestle with God. And there's something about Jacob that, at least to me, and how I read that story and I think about it, is an amazing story. But it tells me that it's okay to wrestle with God. It's okay to struggle. It's okay to have questions. It's okay to call out to God and say, God, I need your help. I want your blessing. I want you to help me. I want you to change me. I think the story of the wrestling match with Jacob is one of many great stories in the Bible, and I find it one that speaks to me. And so last week we talked about the wrestling with God and what that meant for Jacob. I think it was a pivotal time in his life, and it certainly is an instructive time for me. And as I think about that story, reading Genesis chapter 33, we're going to read the entire chapter, verses 1 through 20. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. He put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children next, and Rachel and Joseph in the rear. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground seven times as he approached his brother. But Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Then Esau looked up and saw the women and children. "Who are these with you?" he asked. Jacob answered, "They are the children God has graciously given your servant." Then the maidservants and their children approached and bowed down. Next, Leah and her children came and bowed down. Last of all came Joseph and Rachel, and they too bowed down. Esau said, "What do you mean by all these droves I met?" "To find favor in your eyes, my lord," he said. But Esau said, "I already have plenty, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself." "No, please," said Jacob, "if I have found favor in your eyes, accept this gift from me. For to see your face is like seeing the face of God, now that you have received me favorably. Please accept the present that was brought to you, and for God has been gracious to me, and I have all I need." And because Jacob insisted, Esau accepted it. Then Esau said, "Let us be on our way, I'll accompany you." But Jacob said to him, "My lord knows that the children are tender, and that I must care for the ewes and cows that are nursing their young. If they are driven hard just one day, all the animals will die. So let my lord go on ahead of his servant while I move along slowly at the pace of the droves before me and that of the children until I come to my lord in Seir." Esau said, "Then let me leave some of my men with you." "But why do that?" Jacob asked. "Just let me find favor in the eyes of my lord." So that day Esau started on his way back to Seir. Jacob, however, went to Succoth, where he built a place for himself and made shelters for his livestock. That is why the place is called Succoth. After Jacob came from Padan Aram, he arrived safely at the city of Shechem in Canaan and camped within sight of the city. For 100 pieces of silver he bought from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, the plot of land where he pitched his tent. Then he set up an altar and called it El Aloha, Israel. On one hand, Jacob has just had what could be called the most incredible experience of his life. He's had an encounter with God himself. He sees it that way. He builds the altar and describes it that way. He has met the face of God. He feels like he has come before God, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and now it's his God too. And he's had an experience. He's had several experiences, but just the night before this meeting, he's had maybe the most incredible experience of his life as he wrestled all night with God. He has wrestled with God perhaps about who he is and what he's done and where he's going and what God wants for him, maybe about the covenant, maybe all about Israel. I don't know if you are all about Esau, but if he wrestled all night, he must have had a lot on his mind. He also had, Jacob did, I believe, a very deep faith in God. The fact that Jacob has a number of character flaws, and I don't know what else to call him other than that, character flaws, despite his character flaws, Jacob still shows us something about his depth of faith and believing in God. Certainly God had blessed him. God had called him. God had chosen him. God had reaffirmed the covenant to him. So, Jacob, chapter 32, verse 30 says, if you go back there, it says, "So Jacob called the place Peniel, saying, 'It is because I saw God face to face, and yet my life was spared.'" I don't know how many people can say that they saw God face to face. I mean, there's probably times, maybe times in your life, when you feel like you have encountered the presence of God uniquely. Maybe you've had an experience that no one else has. I don't know about that. But I would not say I've ever had the experience of feeling like I encountered God face to face. But Jacob describes it that way. And then you notice when he sees his brother Esau, and his brother Esau shows favor on him, what does he say to him? He says, "When I see you, it's like seeing the face of God." Jacob has already seen the face of God in the wrestling match, and then when he comes together with his brother, and his brother receives him favorably, Jacob says, "It's just like what happened to me last night. I saw God. I saw God's face." In other words, I believe it just is saying that Jacob is saying that God is leading me. God is with me. God has shown me something. "And now, Esau, that I found favor in your eyes, I have seen God's face, and God has blessed me." And at that time of the seeing of the face of God, God changed his name. No longer will be he called the deceiver, but instead he will be called Israel, meaning I struggle with God. All these things are just evidence of the name, and the name of Israel. I mean, you think about the name of Israel. That's what God's people are called for the rest of the Old Testament and into the New Testament, and for that matter today, Israel. Struggling with God, and how true that's been, how God's people have always struggled with him. So on one hand, you have God and Jacob with this unique relationship, and on the other hand, Jacob knows that he's coming to that moment in his life that he must face his past. He has been running. He has been hiding. But I'm sure there's probably not a whole lot of time that has gone gone by in Jacob's life in these years in between that he hasn't thought about Esau. Perhaps he has thought many, many times about his growing up years, about his father Isaac, who he's not seen now for 20 years, his mother Rebekah. Maybe he remembers what it was like when he left home. His mother actually came to him and said, "Jacob, you got to get up and leave right away because Esau, your brother, wants to kill you." He was running. Years ago, he had done something that he knew was wrong. He had to have known that what he did to his father Isaac in itself was so dishonoring to Isaac, and it was wrong. And then to steal the brother's blessing. Jacob had these relationships from his past, and he needed to face them. Perhaps the words were still in his mind that Esau had spoken, "The days of mourning, for my father is near, then I will kill my brother." Maybe he's just absolutely afraid also. I mean, all through this story, he appears to be afraid. Jacob doesn't go to see Esau because he feels confident or he feels like, he got the better of him and he's the stronger. He goes to see Esau in the state of fear. He remembers back, maybe to Esau's reaction, but maybe he remembers back to the way that he treated him as well. Jacob had an extraordinary relationship with God, but he also had to have been filled with fear and anxiety, fear and uncertainty. He had been hiding for 20 years, but yet he knew he had to face his past. He knew that God called him to go back to the land of promise, to go back to his father, to go back to that land that had been promised. You wonder about how meaningful and important and strong the call of the covenant was to Jacob. I mean, he clearly knew that God said, Jacob, I will give you the same blessings as I gave to Abraham and I gave to Isaac, and you have to come back to the land to do that. So Jacob goes back both with a unique relationship with God, but also with fear and uncertainty about who would his brother be. Maybe he's had contact with his brother. We don't know. It doesn't say, but he sent emissaries to meet Esau, and so he had to know where to find him and how to find him, and he knew that he had to face it, but he didn't know what kind of Esau he would find. Every day, perhaps, he still thought about that. Would Esau still be angry? Would he be vengeful? Would Esau's personality of rebelliousness, which is kind of just what I summarize it toward his parents in some ways, at least in the choosing of his wives, would Esau's character have gotten worse over the years? And then he hears the news. Esau's on his way. You know, that could be one way or another. Then he hears that he's bringing 400 men with him. Jacob looked up, and there was Esau coming with his 400 men. Imagine what Jacob was feeling. He sees him off in the distance. You can see out across the, you know, treeless land, which is pretty much most of Israel and Jordan and Syria. And, you know, it just, there's oasis and waterways, but for the most part, it's a wilderness and a dry area. And so he's there, and he sees him coming from a distance, his family and his animals and his servants. I don't know how many Jacob had. We don't know how big he had. We know that he grew a lot. We knew that he grew a lot when he was with Laban, and God blessed him. I don't know that he had 400 men with him. I doubt that. I doubt that he had near that many. And when he hears Esau's coming, it had to be an overwhelming force of men that was coming in. And why would 400 men come with Esau? You think about it, well, why would Esau come with 400 men? I mean, there's a couple different possibilities about that. At this point, there seems to be. And of course, the one that seems the biggest is Esau's got plenty of men because he's going to come and settle the score. Jacob has been away, and perhaps Jacob felt like, well, Esau, he's just still angry, and he said he was going to kill me, and so now he's coming with 400 men. Of course, the other side of that is perhaps in Esau's heart, and maybe we'll get closer to that as we continue to look in the story, is Esau brings 400 men to say to his brother, I want you to come home, and I want to help you come home. We're going to bring all of you home, and I'm going to protect you and bring you through this land that's hostile and bring you home. Of course, at this time, Jacob doesn't know that. And so Jacob quickly assumes the worst. He divides his family. This picture of the dividing of the family is something that's always intrigued me as well. He has four wives, and he has 11 sons and a daughter. And I know last week I said 11 daughters and a son, but I didn't know it till people told me later on. So he divides it, his maidservants out front with their sons, and then Leah, and then his favored wife, Rebekah, in the back, and Joseph, the favored son. Again, Jacob shows what I would say and I would call partiality. He shows a weakness in his character in how he divides his family. I'm not sure what plan he should have done, and maybe that's an arguable point, but whatever, we look at it, I look at it, and I think, what a thing to do to your maidservants. What a thing to do to Leah, your first wife. Showing partiality, another of Jacob's character flaws. It would seem to protect Rachel as best he could, even if it meant that harm would come to the rest of his family first. But I do notice about this that Jacob doesn't go to the rear or flee. He goes to the front. He goes out in front of his family. And he alone goes to face Esau. Verse 3 describes it like this. He himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. 7 times. I don't know if Jacob planned to bow down or thought this through ahead of time or maybe the night before or 2 weeks before or when he contemplated going to Esau, he just knew that he was going to go and bow down. It's possible. It could be that in the fear of the moment and the heat of the moment, Jacob does what in the culture would say would be an act that would say a lot to Esau. This, of course, the bowing down of seven times is a cultural act, but we do see in it a great deal. Number one, we see in Jacob a sign of humility, a sign of bowing down, something that may have been very, very absent in Jacob's character 20 years before. I imagine from what we do know about character as a young man, maybe as a teenager, and during that time that he manipulated his brother for the birthright and then stole the blessing, there wasn't much humility in Jacob. But bowing down was a sign of humility. It also could have been that he bowed down simply out of fear. Fear that Esau could do whatever he wanted to him and was bowing down in order to say, I'm afraid of you, and I kind of give myself to you. I mean, Jacob knew that he needed to face Esau. We saw that in the last chapter. But he's bowing down, and bowing down in this way is a submissive sign to his older brother. Maybe Jacob is saying, this is what I should have done 20 years ago, but I didn't do that. Bowing once would have shown respect, but bowing seven times showed submission. It showed that Jacob was placing himself into Esau's hands. Maybe in the same way that he had placed himself in God's hands, maybe it's better to say what Jacob was doing was trusting God, saying, God, I am coming, and now I'm going to throw myself before Esau. You said you're with me. You said you would protect me. You said you would bring me back to the land and watch out for me. So he bows down seven times. It may have been Jacob's way to ask for forgiveness. It may have been, again, we don't know exactly what was going through his heart and his mind. Maybe it was a way for Jacob to say, I'm sorry. All those things that we think perhaps are a part of why he bowed down. Maybe he was bowing down to say, Esau, I've done wrong to you. And he wanted to say in some way that he wanted this conflict to be solved and this problem to be solved. Whatever was going on in Jacob's heart and Jacob's mind almost doesn't matter, because you look at verse 4 and you have two words that start the verse, but Esau. But Esau. No matter what was going on in Jacob's life and heart, and we kind of speculate and we kind of think and read between the lines about everything that's going on in Jacob's life. He had done the wrong. Not that Esau hadn't done wrong, but Jacob is the one that wronged his brother. But you know, it all gets solved with two words in verse 4. But Esau. You see, the one that's been wronged and harmed, you see in this part of the story how God has worked in the life of Esau. And no matter what was going on in Jacob's guilt, in his fear, in his sorrow, in wanting to resolve it, or whatever he was thinking, it really doesn't matter, because when they come together, you have these words in verse 4, but Esau. It says here, but Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. Boy, what a picture, what a story. There's Esau coming with 400 men. We really don't know what's going on in Esau's heart and mind until he speaks and he acts, and then we we see this picture of this man who's not seen his brother for 20 years. And he knows he's been wronged, but somewhere a long time ago, Esau has been able to forgive it and let it go. Somewhere along the way. I just love this story. Something about forgiveness in this story that I think is very powerful. It's a reminder that God can help us to forgive when we need to. God can help us to face painful situations in our life and make the choice to forgive. And that's what I see in Esau. It says he ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him. And they wept. What all they meant by that, I'm not sure. But I tell you, it does remind me of a story in the New Testament and a beautiful story that Jesus told. You know the story of the prodigal son? The prodigal son had been gone a long way. He had wronged the father very much. And you know what? The father was waiting and waiting and waiting. And then the son finally came to his senses and he made his way. He started coming back home. But the father doesn't wait till the son gets home. The father waits until the son starts back home. And it says, while he is a far way off, the father sees him and he runs and he embraces him and he kisses him And you see in the story of Jacob, I wonder if Jesus took from the story of Jacob and Esau to tell his story. I don't know if that's true. But you look at the words in this story and you look at that parable, and the words are almost the same right there. Demonstrating, maybe Jesus was saying and reminding us, if you want to look for a picture of the heart of God, you want to look for what it means to really forgive, let me tell you the story of Jacob and Esau. And he tells that story. While he is still far off, the father runs and embraces him. The son, in the story of the prodigal son, what does the son do? The son says, I just want to be a servant. Would you let me come back? What does Jacob do? He brings all the animals and he tries to give a gift. He tries to say, Esau, here, I'm bringing you all this stuff. I'm bowing down seven times. Jacob doesn't understand yet. He doesn't realize what it is to be forgiven. He doesn't quite believe or know how to handle that, or maybe not able to accept it yet, or he doesn't understand. He doesn't know if it's real. He doesn't know if Esau is real. But you see Jacob trying to earn the forgiveness of Esau. In the same way, when the son comes back, he's trying to earn the forgiveness of the father. I want to be a, if you just let me be a servant. It seems like Jacob comes back and he says, I'll give you all these things, and if only I can find favor in your eyes. He says that three times in this chapter. He didn't really need to say it ever once, but three times he said, if I can just find favor in your eyes. If I can just find favor in your eyes. It's kind of how we are when we want to earn the favor of God. We want God to know how sincere we are, and that we can earn. But you know, we can't earn forgiveness from God. You can't do enough to earn forgiveness of God. Forgiveness is free and clear from God. He offers it as a gift. That's how the Bible describes salvation and eternal life. It is the gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. So to me, the story of Jacob and Esau just draws in some theological things that are important to us about salvation and about forgiveness and about being forgivable. I mean, there's a couple ways to look at that, and we usually think about forgiveness and how we need to forgive, but also, you know, some people really struggle with being forgivable. They want to somehow do something else or convince God of this or that so that then God will show favor on them. But, you know, Esau did not need all those things to forgive Jacob. Esau made a decision to forgive Jacob. What are all these droves, Esau says? I think he's saying, what's all these animals you sent ahead to me? Jacob, what's that about? And what does Jacob say? To find favor in your eyes. What do you mean by all these droves I met to find favor in your eyes, my Lord? You know, I don't know exactly what's going on in Jacob and Esau, but we read this and we think about these things that, you know, the father and the prodigal son had no interest in his son being a servant. He wanted to forgive. He wanted to have a party. And what a beautiful picture. Jacob is trying to find a way to earn Esau's favor. He doesn't quite understand yet what it means to be forgiven. But Esau, for his part, it's already taken care of. For Esau's part in the story, it's already done. The decision's been made. Maybe there was a struggle, I don't know how long. But there's several things about forgiveness that I think are pretty neat in this story. Jacob struggles to be forgiven. He struggles to believe. And some people are like that. I don't know if anybody here is like that. But you know, there's some people that really struggle with the forgiveness of God. They just seem to not get what grace and mercy is. I mean, it is just God giving us something that's so special. We can't earn it. We can't be good enough. In other words, Esau, it would seem, long ago had been set free. Somewhere back in the 20 years, I don't know if it's closer to 20 or the last few or whatever, but Esau seems to long ago have let it go, and he's been able to forgive. Let's think about a few things about Esau's forgiveness. Number one is, apparently it was immediate, at least at this point. I don't know if, again, the decision was made 20 years ago or 18 years ago or 10 years ago. I don't know. But when they got to this point together, the decision on that day was, I forgive you. And you know, I think forgiveness, sometimes you have to make it every day. When you're struggling with somebody that's wronged you, you have to kind of drive the stake down at some point in your life and say, I choose to forgive. But then the next day and the next day, you might have to go back and tap it in again or tap on it a little bit, because somehow that stake can find its way coming back out. That's why I feel about forgiveness. A lot of people say, well, I have a hard time forgiving. I want to, but I can't. And I think of it like a stake. You know, you got to drive that. You got to make the purpose. You got to purposely say, I'm driving the stake in. I'm going to forgive. I'm going to forgive my whatever. I'm going to forgive my parents. I'm going to forgive my brother. I'm going to forgive my husband. I'm going to forgive my boss. I'm going to forgive my company. I'm going to forgive whatever it is, the choice to forgive. At some point, you got to take a stake and you start driving it in. But then, maybe, if you're still struggling with it, you just might come back and hit it again. Because we are weak, and sometimes that's hard. But whatever it is with Esau, however he did it, when he came to Jacob, immediately he had the choice to forgive. Also, it's evident, too, that another point about forgiveness, Esau made the decision to forgive before Jacob asked for it. I don't know about when Jacob sent the animals and how, you know, what all that meant. It seems like Esau saying, I don't know why you're doing that. Somewhere back there, Esau, before Jacob asked him to, you might say before Jacob confessed and repented, Esau chose to forgive him. I know also that with forgiveness, sometimes we have a feeling that we can't forgive until somebody asks us to. That is theologically wrong. Forgiveness is your choice and your decision, independent of whether somebody else is ever sorry or not. It helps if they're sorry, and if they're sorry and they show that, then there can often be reconciliation and there can be a way to bring back a relationship. Without that confession and repentance, that's very hard, if not impossible, to do. But forgiveness can. And for Christians, and for people who want to be right with God, forgiveness needs to take place whether or not somebody is sorry. Because forgiveness is our way of holding on to the wrong. It's our way of holding judgment over somebody when we know that judgment is of God. And they are in God's hands. But somehow Esau forgave Jacob before he ever asked him to, before he ever did all this stuff about wanting to find favor in your eyes. Jacob should have done that. I mean, that's a part of reconciliation. It's part of confession. It's a part of taking ownership for hurting and wronging someone. And, you know, someone should always do that if they wrong somebody else. But on this side, I'm talking about Esau's side, he made the decision to forgive regardless of his brother's attitude. I think there's something instructive about that, about forgiveness. I mean, forgiveness is a big issue for us sometimes. There are people that have hurt us. There are people that have done things that have been painful for us. But I look at this story and I see an example of forgiveness that causes me to look at it a little bit different. Esau forgave Jacob before Jacob ever asked him to. Who was set free by that? Esau was. Who was helped by that? Esau was. Who was blessed by that? Esau was. Also, Esau's forgiveness was expressed openly. You know, it's not like he just said, I forgive him. He expressed it and he said it. And he meant it. Tried to say it a couple different ways. Esau, it's over. It's okay. It's in the past. It's forgiven. Expressed. That's hard to do when you've been hurt. So this is a good story just to think about if you've been hurt. His forgiveness was complete. It was over. Boom. Let it go. Letting it go is hard to do. Forgiveness is one thing. Letting it go is something else. But they're obviously related. Sometimes it is hard to let it go. But Esau was able, and his example is to do both. Just as the father in the parable, he was able to do both. He's able to forgive. He was able to let it go. He was able to receive back. In this case, the prodigal son who came back and said he was sorry. And then there was a restoration of relationship. Know that without that taking ownership of what one has done, then the possibility of restoring relationship is difficult, if not impossible. But in the story of the prodigal son, that's what happened. And in this story, this is what happened. It was complete. It was also lasting. It makes me think that probably God has already been working on Esau, maybe for a long time. Unknown to us, unknown to the Scripture, unknown to the Bible. Really, we don't know that, but it looks like probably Esau has encountered God too somewhere in the 20 years. See, we don't know how God is dealing with the other party when we've been hurt or forgiveness is an issue. We may think that, well, they've messed up and they've done me wrong, and so God is pretty much has my opinion and God's cut them off too. You know? They've done me dirty and they've hurt me and they can just stay out there. And we kind of have the attitude, well, that's probably what God does too. That's not what God does. God reaches out with His Spirit. And we may not know what God does in the lives of somebody that's hurt us, but God may be working in their lives. And maybe even there's more fruit in that than we realize. And maybe more fruit than even in our lives when we deal with past and the pain and forgiveness issues. We don't know how God is dealing with the other person. And we should be so careful in our judgments about that. We let that up to God. And even pray, God, would you work in the heart of that person that's wronged me or wronged someone? God, would you do your work in their heart? I leave that up to you. I just say, God, help me. Work on me, God. Whatever you can do in the life of the other person, I say, please, God. Bring them back. If they've done wrong, make them sorry. Pray that they'll respond. Pray for them that God will be as merciful and gracious to them as you want God to be to you. God had been working on Esau. We don't know exactly how long and what and how, but he'd been working on Esau. And at this point in his life, Esau has a Esau, you might look at it this way. Jacob was the chosen one. He's the blessed one. God had been coming and meeting with Jacob, and all these altars have been built and all this great stuff. And that it's quite a story. But you know what? Who we see God has really dealt with in this story is the one that needed to forgive. Because when they come together, Esau's been able to do that. This is a neat story. We don't know a lot about Jacob and Esau after this story. We know a little bit about them. We don't know if they were ever close. You know, when you've been hurt by someone, maybe being close is not ever possible. Sometimes in families it's that way. You got a division and something painful. Even though you forgive, you know, it's like you still got to drive in that stake and you have feelings and those things. Don't know about Jacob and Esau. These are kind of unknowns to us. For one reason, because the Bible doesn't continue that narrative. It shifts to the promised son, Jacob, and what happens to him from now on. But it does seem that they were brothers again. They went their separate ways. If you read on in the text, and I did read in the chapter, well, what happened to him after this? I mean, they come together, and go to that map, would you, Andy? And basically, Peniel is to the right. It's the black box at the top to the right. That's a place called Peniel. Straight down to that line, goes down kind of below the Dead Sea and to the east, the place called Seir. And that's where the Edomites were, the descendants of Esau. That's where Esau's family moved to and lived to. What Jacob did is Jacob went west to Succoth, which is the next box. I know you probably can't read it. And then across the Jordan River to Shechem. What Jacob did is Jacob went to the land that God told him to go to. In this story, it seems like maybe Jacob was being deceptive again, and that's possible. I mean, Esau says, "Well, are you gonna come to see her?" And Jacob, "Yeah, I'll see you and see her. We'll catch up with you sometime." And what happens is Jacob doesn't go there then, at least for sure. He goes where God had told him to go, roughly. Basically, go back to the land of your father. Because you go from Succoth to Shechem, and then Bethel, and then Ephrath, and then Hebron. And Hebron was where Isaac and Abraham lived. So what Jacob does is he goes back to where his family, Abraham and Isaac, had settled, and he lives the rest of his life there. Whereas Esau goes south to Seir and lives the rest of his life. Maybe Jacob still was a little bit afraid. That's possible. But I think it's more likely that Jacob knew where he was going. First, he knew he had to meet with Esau. He had to deal with Esau. And then he would go to the land that had been promised to him. I do notice here that he builds another altar. Verse 20 says, "There he set up an altar and called it Eloah, Israel, my God." He goes from Esau. He goes across the Jordan River and to Shechem, and he builds an altar there, and he says, "My God." He's back home. He's back in the land that God had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and now to Jacob. "My God," simply the Hebrew, "My God." The brothers, what do we know about them and their relationship? We know that they come together once more. They could have many, many times. It's likely they did, but we don't know that because the narrative doesn't tell us. But they do come together one more time. And then Esau moves on with his life. Jacob moves on, and the Bible follows Jacob. But here they went their separate ways. Well, in chapter 35, verse 39, the very end of that chapter, it says, Jacob came home to his father Isaac in Mamre near Kir-Abba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had stayed. Isaac lived 180 years, then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. Basically, Jacob went back home, and he lived with his father and his father's householder in that area until he died. And then he said, then he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, old and full of years, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. Short statement, and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. They came together, at least at that point, and together they did what sons would do. And again, doesn't show us a whole lot, but it shows us that there was a connection in order to do it. They bury him together. Chapter 36 does tell us one other little clue about why Esau went to Seir and Jacob did not. If it be the last thing I want to refer to, chapter 36, verse 6 says, "Esau took his wives and sons and daughters and all the members of his household, as well as his livestock and all his other animals and all the goods he had acquired in Canaan, and moved to a land some distance from his brother Jacob. Their possessions were too great for them to remain together. The land where they were staying could not support them both because of their livestock." Now, I don't know exactly when that was in Jacob and Esau's life, but it had to be after they came back. Apparently, they were together for a while, and they realized that they had so many possessions. God had blessed them both in so many ways that it was decided, maybe because Esau had lived there before anyway. He had taken wives of the Canaanites, and maybe wives, and one of them was from that area, we know for sure. But sometime later, the decision was made that Esau was going to move away, and he did. And then we don't know any more about Esau. That's pretty much it. We know about his descendants. We know about the Edomites. We know about the Israelite people coming up through that land from Egypt and a lot of things from that. But that's what we know about Esau. The book of Genesis then turns to Jacob and his children, the 12 sons of Jacob, and Joseph, and the story of Joseph. And then we hear about how God will continue to work in those generations in that line. And that's where I am thinking to pick up this story in January, Lord willing. We're going to turn our attention to the holidays the next few weeks and special services and things that we have planned. And then in January, I'm thinking to turn back and then kind of begin a study of Joseph, and especially Joseph and his life that's an incredible as well, as we go into the fourth generation of the covenant people and the promise of God in Genesis.